I'd like now to welcome back to the show Bill Robichaud. He is a zoologist. He's coordinator of the Sow Law Working Group. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
It's great to have you back. Now, we can, I think, make the claim that we are the greatest featurer of the Sow Law mammal in radio on this planet, at least so far we have been. What is the Sow Law?
Yeah, we are by far your show, the great. And Sow Law is so little known, unfortunately, that's not saying a lot. But Sow Law is an extraordinary large mammal. It's about the size of a white-tailed deer. It actually looks more like an Arabian oryx or an antelope, although it's distantly related to cattle. So it's a bit of a mystery. And it was completely unknown to the outside world until 1992, when it was discovered during a biological survey in a protected area of Vietnam along the border with Laos. And it's this remarkable animal. It doesn't look like anything else in Southeast Asia. It's got long horns, about 2 feet long, beautiful white spots on the face, and lives in very dense forest in the Annamite Mountains, which form the border between Laos and Vietnam.
And it's one of the most endangered mammals in the whole world. And even the people like you, who have devoted your lives to studying and saving this animal, have barely ever seen it and are not even positive that there's still really members of that species existent on the planet.
We know it's there, but you're right. Sow Law has the distinction of being by far the largest terrestrial animal in the world of undisputed existence that's never been seen in the wild by a biologist. You know, there's some things in the deep oceans, maybe like giant squid and things, that haven't been seen yet, but this is by far the largest land animal that's never been seen by a biologist. So some days it feels like trying to conserve a unicorn.
Right, and it feels like a unicorn with those long, straight horns, and its kind of mythical shyness.
Right. But we do know it's there because we have seen captives. I saw a captive in 1996. There was one caught in Laos, which was photographed in 2010. And on occasion, we've gotten camera trap photographs of it. And the villagers who live in its range give us fairly detailed information about when they've seen it and when they've caught it. And it's not an animal you can readily mistake for anything else.
It's unique in the sense that it's not only an unusual species, but it's the only animal in its entire genus?
Yeah, it's the only animal in its genus, and taxonomically it's so unusual it probably merits its own subfamily. It's a very ancient member of the family that includes cattle and wild buffalo, domestic buffalo also, although it doesn't look anything like a cow. As I said, it looks more like, its genus name is Pseudo-Oryx, because it looks superficially like the oryxes of North Africa, but it's not an oryx. It's more closely related to cows and buffalo.
So since the last time we've seen you, you've been doing all kinds of efforts on multiple fronts to conserve the animal, to raise awareness, to do fundraising, to identify the animal, to see where it is and see how you can further study it. And of course, it's one animal in a larger ecosystem, and so it's not just the story of this creature, it's the story of its world.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't conserve species in isolation. And what's fascinating for me about the Sow Law is not just the Sow Law, but the place in which it lives, which is the Annamite Mountains, this forested mountain range along the Lao-Vietnam border. And it's one of the most extraordinary forests and ecosystems on Earth. Once biologists discovered the Sow Law in 1992, we started paying a bit more close attention to the Annamite Mountains. And after the Sow Law's own discovery in 1992, colleagues and I, people working there, have discovered at least two new species of barking deer. My colleague Rob Timmons found a new species of beautiful striped rabbit. There's a form of wild pig that was thought hadn't been seen for 100 years, was rediscovered in the Annamites. Just in the last couple of years, my colleagues found a very unusual bald songbird. I mean, bald on the head. It's the only bald songbird in Asia. It's turned up in the Annamites. And a small mammal about the size of one of your fat New Mexico ground squirrels, maybe a little bit bigger, jet black, however. It's a rodent, but it's entirely new taxonomic family of rodent. They thought it was new, and they described it as a new family and a new genus of strange rodent. It turns out it's actually representative of a fossil what was thought to be a fossil family that hadn't been seen for more than 5 million years in
the fossil record.
And it's turned up in limestone in the Annamite Mountains of Laos. So the Sao La is just sort of the most spectacular story that started off our whole understanding of the absolute amazing place that the Annamite Mountains are. But it's not just the biological diversity, it's also the cultural diversity. And one of the largest protected area in the Annamites, Nakhinam Thun National Protected Area in Laos, it's the largest protected area anywhere with Sao La. A linguist, anthropologist colleague of mine, James Chamberlain, went into this area in 1996, and he discovered three new languages and ethnic groups that had not been known before. I mean, we knew that these villages were there, but it wasn't until James showed up that he realized that these people are speaking a language, and they call themselves, describe themselves in a way that defines them as a new ethnic group that was never known before. And he called Nakhinam Thun an area of cultural megadiversity. Because of this one area, there's about 6,000 people live, and they speak about 20 different languages. And while you have diversity like that, like in valleys in Papua New Guinea, these languages are in four different major language families. So it's an incredible mixing of people, and some of them have been there for a very, very, very long time.
Getting off the subject of Sao La for a second, since you brought this all up, you have biodiversity and I think a kind of coming to be ever more general understanding that biodiversity is an important thing. It keeps ecosystems healthy. If you have monocrops, they're very vulnerable and things like that. What about cultural diversity? Is it equally valuable in a practical sense in terms of keeping cultures healthy?
I'm not sure if practical is the right word. But in fact, this same colleague, James Chamberlain, he said in a place like Nakhinam Thun, it doesn't make any sense to talk about cultural diversity and biodiversity because the cultures are so dependent on the biodiversity of the area.
Right.
So he said it only makes sense to talk about biocultural diversity of a place like Nakhinam Thun. I mean, I've never really believed that there's any such thing as natural. I mean, what, humans aren't natural? I mean, where did we come from? We came from Jupiter? Well, even if we came from Jupiter, Jupiter isn't
That's
natural.
Nature.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that natural has any meaning that you can separate, especially in a place like Nakhinam Thun, where the people are, you know, basically everything they eat on a daily basis is something that they found in the forest that day or took from, you know, one of the forest streams that day. So to try to separate the human from the natural is just an artificial construction of
Right,
minds.
And especially in a place like where you're living and studying, the natural world is the human world.
Yeah, and vice versa.
Yep. You might have a little more trouble saying that as easily in New York City.
Yeah, but it's just because where did their plastic cell phones come from? It came from the oil of fossil plants and animals.
I mean,
there's nothing. I just don't. I think they trying to construct, you know, artificial or human versus natural is a very unhelpful course. It gets humans into the habit of forgetting that everything they have for existence and life has come from nature and is coming from nature and is being mined from nature and is going to run out soon.
Now, this area was also one of the most heavily bombed areas during the Vietnam War.
Absolutely. Because the Annamite Mountains are along the Lao-Vietnam border, a large part of them basically correspond to routes of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And this is the supply route that the North Vietnamese used to supply arms and other things to the Viet Cong guerrillas in southern Vietnam fighting the U.S. and South Vietnamese army. So the main part of this trail went through Laos and went through what's now the Annamites and went through places where Sao La are still hanging on. Yeah, and Laos was the most bombed country per capita in the history of warfare. At the time of the Vietnam War, it was a population of about 3 million people. And the U.S. dropped more bombs on Laos than were dropped on all countries of Europe during World War II. So it's had a tremendous impact on the country. Biologically, I mean, Agent Orange spraying has destroyed a lot of forests that hasn't come back yet. I'm sure just the physical bombing must have, you know, killed a lot of people, obviously. I'm sure it also killed one heck of a lot of elephants, tigers, rhinos, and Sao La.
We're talking to Bill Robichaud about the cell law. So what kind of advances have you made in preservation, in biology, and so on since we last talked, which was, what, about a year ago?
Right. Well, something is very exciting. It was just published in the last week in the journal Current Biology, and the journal Nature published a news story about it. One of the constraints of sow law conservation, one of the challenges we face is this difficulty of detecting the animal. If you go into a forest, you can tell very quickly if there are tigers there or there are elephants there because their tracks and their signs are very distinctive. Sow law, it's a hoofed mammal, but there are other mammals of about the same size that live in the same forest. And we've had so little experience of the animal, it's hard for us to identify with certainty its tracks from similar-sized hoofed animals in its habitat. I'm sure there are local hunters in the villages. I mean, many local hunters claim they can identify sow law tracks with certainty, and I believe that they can. The problem with this is, I mean, hunters in villages are like people everywhere else. They have varying degrees of talent and integrity even. So while I'm sure some hunters can identify sow law tracks from others, I don't know which ones really can and really can't. So we don't have any way to really go into a forest very quickly and confirm that there's sow law there. We've tried to put out automatic camera traps that'll take a photo of animals moving in front of it.
Now, a camera trap means that an animal's going by, it trips a wire that takes its picture.
It actually trips. It's just it's more passive than that. It's a camera and a housing. You put it on a tree with bungee cords, and it has a passive infrared sensor usually.
Oh, okay.
And anything that's warm or moving that comes within range of that infrared sensor, the camera will take a photograph.
So you get a lot of pictures.
Yeah, we get a lot of pictures of a lot of stuff, but not very many of sow law. We've only gotten four, possibly five photographs of sow law since it was discovered in 1992.
Oh, my goodness.
And the village said one reason this for, when I was working with the villagers setting the camera traps, they said, look, William, this thing is not going to be easy to photograph. Sow law is much more wary than the deer and the wild pigs and the other things in the forest. And it's not very excitable, but it's very cautious and very wary. And it's a solitary animal, and you don't see herds of sow law. So they just said, yeah, we'll help you try this, but we're going to tell you it's not going to be easy to photograph this. So you have an animal that's already very rare, it's at low density. The forest that it lives in is very wet. It's always, there's a lot of mist and rain. It's very cool, which is not very conducive to camera trapping. So we've faced a lot of challenges, too. And the distribution of sow law in the Annamite Mountains is patchy. And what we want to do is know where the most important populations are, so we can prioritize the protection efforts there. And it's very difficult for us to do this now. Well, something quite potentially exciting has just happened in the last several months. Some geneticists at the University of Copenhagen and the Natural History Museum of Denmark, a team led by a young Englishman named Dr. Tom Gilbert, they work on ancient DNA. They're experts at getting DNA out of like permafrost, out of soils, out of old bones and things like this. And they contacted one of the members of the sow law working group, Nicholas Wilkinson, whose name they'd got, and they said, you know, we think maybe we can find the blood of mammals that leeches have fed on, and we wonder if this could be used to find things like sow law. So they did through much trial, they got medicinal leeches from Europe to feed on some goat blood. They tried all sorts of things. They put this goat blood in condoms and warmed them up and tried to get the leeches to suck it out through the condoms. And they said it was actually more challenging than they... I don't know why they just didn't stick them on the goat, but
yeah.
I think they were trying to control something in the lab. Well, they eventually did this. They did this with, I don't know, dozens of leeches. And then every several days or every week, they would kill some of these leeches and see if they could still detect the goat DNA in the leech. After 4 months, they were still detecting goat DNA, and they ran out of leeches to try this on. So they proved that for at least 4 months, you can detect the DNA of the last animal that a leech fed on, at least in the laboratory. So they contacted Nicholas, and they said, we want to do a little field trial of this. Could you pick up some leeches in Vietnam, in the forest in Vietnam, and send them to us? So Nicholas did. He picked up 25 leeches. He sent them off to Denmark. And amazingly, 22 of these leeches had identifiable mammalian DNA of at least six species of animals. It didn't pick up any salla, but it did pick up one of the new species of deer and this new species of rabbit, which are also very cryptic, plus a thing called a ferret badger, I think wild pig, and a couple of other things. So this was an amazing result, and they just published it in a biological journal last week. And so now we've gotten some grant proposals to do a more thorough test of this method and see, could this be used to detect salla and pinpoint forests where salla occurs?
What does that mean, going around the forest and collecting leeches?
Yeah, they're not hard to find there, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
you can pick 10 or 20 off your foot at one time when it's raining. One of the cool things about the method, it would be possible to go to, say, in a, 2-square-kilometer block of forest or 5-square-kilometer block of forest. We could pick up, say, 1,000 leeches. And basically the lab in Denmark can put them all in a blender and do one test to see if there's any salla DNA amongst those 1,000 leeches. So one test. So it could be an astoundingly cost-efficient method to try to determine if there's any salla there. What we're trying to sort out is if this will really work, because let's say you got 2 salla in this 5-square-kilometer block of forest. The thing is, you got hundreds of other animals that leeches will feed on. Pheasants, birds on the ground, civets, all the wild cats, the bears, the wild pigs, the deer. Trying to find a leech that actually fed on salla and not one of those other hundreds of other animals is still a bit of a needle in a haystack situation.
We're talking to Bill Robichaux. So and we will hear, because I guess you come back to New Mexico every year, we'll hear the next
Maybe.
Update when you come back, because it's a fascinating story. The last times that you've been here on the radio talking to us about this ecosystem and this mammal and everything, there was a real effort to try to bring awareness to not only the people, but the conservation groups around the world, particularly those who do work in Asia, about the importance of this mammal and the fact that it exists in the first place. How's that going?
Yeah, another great development for that is the European Association of Zoos, which is the network of the 340 zoos in Europe. Every year they do an annual campaign of fundraising and awareness. And what they do is they get they pick one beneficiary, one theme. Like one year, I think it was great apes. One year it might have been tigers. One year it might have been wetlands, something like that. And they get their zoos to raise awareness and fundraise for the conservation of this particular theme each year. In some years, they typically raise €1 million. It's close to $1.5 million, and they funnel it to conservation of this. This year, their theme is endangered animals of Southeast Asia. In fact, in recognition of the fact that the greatest extinction crisis in the world today is in Southeast Asia. You hear a lot about conservation in the Amazon and in Africa. The urgency of the situation is unmatched in Southeast Asia. So they're going to do a 2-year campaign, and we persuaded them to make salla the logo of the campaign. And they were at first very reluctant to do that. They said, look, there are no salla in captivity anywhere in the world. We really can't have an animal as logo of our campaign that none of our zoos have. Nobody's ever seen it. There aren't a lot of photographs or video of it that we've been using, campaign materials. And at first they were quite reluctant. And what persuaded them, one of my colleagues sent them the link of the interview you and I did last time.
Oh, wow.
And these guys at the European Association of Zoos listened to it, and they said, oh, my God, we've got to make this animal the logo. We get it now. We're going to make this animal the logo of the campaign. And it was based on them listening to the internet link of our radio interview.
Extraordinary.
So now salla is the logo of this campaign, and I'm going to Austria at the end of May and give a talk at a conference IAS is having on the extinction crisis in Southeast Asia.
It's interesting, I think, important to mention that the reason that they're not in zoos, one of the reasons, besides the fact that they're so rare, is that they never have been able to live in captivity. There
right.
are a couple of stories of salas that have been captured what, just one or two, right? And they always die very quickly. Nobody knows why.
We actually know of several now. Shortly after it was discovered, there were two calves that were caught, probably after killing their mothers, and sent to Hanoi. And they were kept in, like, a scientific institute garden in Hanoi. They lived for a few months. The one that I saw in 1996 was captured by Hmong hunters in response to a reward offer by a general in central Laos who had his own menagerie. And that animal, Martha, which I nicknamed her, got to the menagerie, and I watched her around the clock, and she lived for 18 days and died. And we know of several others, and even have photographs of some of the others that have been in captivity in Laos and Vietnam. The animal is incredibly calm in captivity. I've never seen a wild animal so calm. I mean, I got the one that was held in central Laos in the town of Lak Sao. I was at the menagerie within 3 days of it being captured. She was completely calm and completely tame around people. And even the deer, and there's a wild goat-like thing called a sirao found in the area that the general had in his zoo for more than a year, they were still completely skittish. When you go to one end of their cage and they run to the other side. The Sao La, you could go in the cage and she'd feed out of your hand. I was looking in her ear for ticks and, you know, measuring her while she just stood there and didn't do anything. And some veterinarians I talked to said, oh, this is a thing called post-capture myopathy. She was just so stressed out by her captivity, she was freaked out and acting completely abnormally. But I don't think that was it, because she reacted very strongly to any dog that came anywhere near the pen.
Ah,
and she groomed herself and took care of herself. She fed. She didn't look like an animal. I mean, I've been around animals a lot. This didn't look to me like post-capture stress. And while I was, one of the days when I was looking at her, one of the monks from the temple in the little town, because a lot of local Lao people were coming to look at her in the menagerie, because they were fascinated by it also. This monk was looking at her with me, and he said, oh yeah, we have a nickname for this animal. We call it Sat Su Pap, which means a polite animal. Because the Sao La is always very calm and walks quietly through the forest and never gets upset at anything. It's very wary, but it's not excitable. And man, that was certainly its nature. But it died, and I think the problem, it was probably dietary related. The general staff was doing their best to feed it wild plants that they thought it ate, but it was getting a very, very small variety.
Yeah.
And you can't keep a wild animal like that on two or three plants. It needs a wide variety or it's going to have problems.
Yeah. What is the place of the Sao La in the lives and mythology and so on of the indigenous people who live in its habitat? Do they hunt it? What do they say about it?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's not really been looked at as much. I haven't found any significant spiritual connection to it like they do. They have, many of these groups have very strong beliefs around rhinos, around gaur, which is the huge wild cattle that lives in these forests. I mean, these things are more than 6 feet tall at the withers. I mean, they're taller than I am at the withers. Elephants and tigers. Sao La, I haven't heard anything. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist somewhere. I think actually Nicholas has found, or one of our colleagues in Vietnam, Dr. Chung, he's actually found some information for one of the ethnic groups in Vietnam, but I don't know the details. I haven't yet followed up with him on it. To them, the interesting thing about Sao La is it's, except for the two Southeast Asian rhinos, the only thing, it's one of the most endangered animals in Asia today and in the world, as you said. We don't know how many there are because of the difficulty detecting it. We do have a sense if things are really good, there might be a few hundred left. But we don't know. If things are really bad, there might be 10 left. You know, we don't know. We know it's out there, but we don't know how many. The interesting thing is this extinction crisis in Southeast Asia is being driven by the demand for animals used in traditional East Asian medicine, and also the bushmeat markets, the restaurant markets. And sometimes people have this impression that wild meat is what poor people eat, and that, you know, these animals, you know, there's an extinction problem because some of these countries are very poor and the villages are killing a lot of animals to eat. That's not the case at all. In these countries, wildlife meat is a luxury. It's a luxury sold to fairly rich urban elites. It's much more expensive. I mean, a wild red jungle fowl, which is the ancestor of the wild chicken, is much more expensive in the market than domestic chicken. Wild pig is much more expensive than domestic pig. So the demand is not being, this biodiversity issue is not being driven by poverty. It's being driven by increasing wealth, especially in China, North Vietnam, Korea. There's millions of more people in Chinese with in China with disposable income, and they're buying up. They're just, this demand is vacuuming Southeast Asia empty of almost any type of animal you can think of. The interesting thing is sow la never occurred in China, so it doesn't appear anywhere in the traditional Chinese pharmacopoeia. But the hunters and the poachers, they're out setting wire snares to catch everything else, or shooting everything else, and sow la are more or less bycatch, like the dolphins and tuna scenario. So here's this beautiful, extraordinary animal just kind of drifting through extinction, but nobody's really going out trying to kill sow la. They're just trying to kill other things, and it's getting caught up in the mess.
Is there an awareness campaign in these places in China and Korea and so on about extinction? And I mean, the kind of awareness that we have here in the United States is pretty intense. I mean, whether people are actively supporting their conservation organizations or not, everybody knows about the threat of extinction. What about in China?
Yeah, I think, but I want to back up about the U.S. I mean, all of us know about sustainability. How many of us are living sustainable?
No,
we're
we're
still driving around in our SUVs and complaining that gas is getting towards $4 a gallon. I hope gas goes to $10 a gallon, frankly, if we really want to live sustainably. In China, no, I mean, we have to... The cultural heritage of using wild animals for medicine. And Chinese basically believe that, food is medicine. Medicine is food. So in some ways, they have a much more sustainable medical paradigm than we do in the West. Unfortunately, a lot of the traditional stuff is based on animal use, and the number of people has grown much larger than the resource of wild animals. So this is something, that's been being used and believed in China for thousands and thousands of years, and it's not something that's easily changed overnight.
We're talking to zoologist Bill Robichaud. He's coordinator of the Sow La Working Group, about this endangered mammal, the sow la. Now, you've been doing it for so long, and for me, having you back year after year just makes me think about certain creatures which on some level, and they certainly don't know how much we're thinking about them, but they seem to be an emblem of what we might be able to do to, I don't want to say cliches like save the world, but to actually become more aware of our place in nature and our sharing of nature with everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think the problem is not so much development and technology, but it's the way in which it's used and the way, as you said, awareness. As humans, we're very, very good at taking natural resources without kind of the awareness of where it really comes from. I mean, when you think of everything that went into making your soundboard, all the plastic and the wire, I mean, if we actually fouled it down and all the energy used to make your soundboard here, I mean, it would boggle our minds collectively.
And the number of people involved in taking the petroleum out of the ground, getting the thing here, getting the copper, the circuit boards, the whole thing. I mean, it's like thousands, maybe millions of people go in some way, directly or indirectly, the making of all these gadgets that we use without even thinking about
it. In the energy for the production. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, and I think what we can do is simply be a bit more aware of the way in which we live in the world, the way we move in the world, and how that we're always taking as if there's an inexhaustible supply of nature, I'll call it nature, of natural resources out there, without thinking, well, how do we give something back? How do we feed what's feeding us? Or how do we be a little bit less, ravenous about taking everything? Interesting, one of the things that kind of may have hammered sow la, when I was working in Laos in 2006, 2007 at that time, suddenly the price exploded for rosewood. It's a species of rosewood that grows throughout forests in areas where Saulah lives. It doesn't grow in pure stands. It's like one tree here and one tree there. And, I mean, Laos is one of the quote-unquote economically poorest countries in the world, which is actually a bunch of crap. It's a very wealthy country in natural resource and everything else, but according to the World Bank's and United Nations metric, it's poor, which is a whole other story we could do for another show. But, you know, their average per capita income is $2,000. The price of rosewood that the villagers could sell it to timber traders reached $8,500 a cubic meter in about 2007. And it just went up, and it was a free-for-all of people going in and paying villagers to cut rosewood, and kids running these rosewood timbers up to the Vietnam border on their motorbikes for money. In fact, the attendance in the little local high school went down because the kids were dropping out to poach rosewood. The price peaked about just a few months before the Beijing Summer Olympics, and we had other points of information that suggested this massive timber poaching that went on in Laos, with Vietnamese pouring over the border of Laos and in Vietnam, and why these people are cutting rosewood, they're also setting snares to catch animals to eat, so they're killing Saulah at the same time. It was driven by the demand for the Chinese for probably, you know, making the VIP suites and furniture for the Beijing Summer Olympics. So here's something, you know, something completely unaware of that's going on in the Olympics that is driving this tremendous, it was a biodiversity crisis in Laos and Vietnam and Thailand, and complete unawareness of it. I'm not saying they're at fault for not being aware of it, but this goes on all the time.
I think it is important to talk about this question of wealth and poverty. You've been living in Laos and studying the Saulah and studying this ecosystem for quite a long time now. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to guess that your concept of what even constitutes wealth and poverty has really shifted in doing this work.
Right. The United States is one of the most impoverished countries I've ever lived in. I mean, one of my brothers passed away a few years ago, and there was a question around the family. Oh, we don't really need a memorial ceremony for him. And I thought, what? You're doing this person we've known and loved our entire life, we're just going to drop them like yesterday's newspaper? And I thought, God, this is one of the poorest countries I've ever been in, the United States, where people would even question if we should have a memorial ceremony for somebody who died who we loved our entire lives. And that's what America has lost. We've got one hell of a lot of money. We have very little cultural, I mean, we have a lot of religion, but in my mind, not a lot of spirituality, you know, in connection to the world in that way. And unfortunately, the only, you know, in places like Laos, the only metric, or the people who are defining the metric of well-being tend to be development banks like the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. They're not doing anything wrong. They're bankers and they're economists. So a very easy metric is like average per capita income. But 80% of the villages in Laos are not involved in a cash economy, and they're not connected to external markets. They rely on incredible wealth of natural resources for their well-being. And what I've started to pick up, Mary Charlotte, is amongst, you know, development agencies and development projects, there's almost a resentment towards these villagers that they're not connected to our outside markets. And there's no crap that we can sell them because they don't have roads to the villages and we can't sell them. They're not dependent on us. And they're, you know, they're living independently. And there's this, there's this undercurrent of resentment about that, or maybe it's a reminder to us of what we've lost, and we don't want to have that reminder, so we got to make them into us. Instead of us becoming more like them, we've got to change them into what we are and drag them into our dysfunction.
And at the same time, what you have is people who are, I mean, if you talk about sustainable, which has become kind of a buzzword or even a cliche, but these are people who are truly, genuinely sustainable in the most genuine sense of the word. I mean, they're living off the land.
Absolutely. Now, one of the problems, as soon as you even start broaching the subject, then you get people try to slap you down. And say, oh, you're talking about noble savages, and you want to keep these people in some kind of ethnic zoo. It's not that at all. For me, it's largely about self-determination in some ways. honoring what people already have. I mean, some of the villages I was involved in Laos, the World Bank came in with a quote-unquote development project. And the entire perspective of the project, of these people living up in the forest where the Sao Lao lived, were poor. And the World Bank had to save them from their poverty. So they decided to start this in like three pilot villages in this area in the Kainam Tun. And they went into the... They didn't ask the villages if they wanted to be involved. They got together with their Lao government colleagues, and they basically went in and said, you know, we're going to do this development project for you. And at least one of the villages, they said, no, go away. We're fine. We don't want any involvement of outsiders, and especially you guys, in our village. You know, we've had a lot of broken promises from development projects, and we're actually fine. In fact, one of the villagers told one of the staff that he said, no, we don't actually need any help. We're not poor. We're actually pretty well off, you know, and we're much better off than we were a few years ago, and we don't feel poor. So the bank was defining them as poor, even in their mission reports. But the people didn't perceive, they weren't, you had to basically, the project had to first teach them that they were poor, in a way, to get them to accept the project. And so they did. They went along the project. The project did not go well. The villagers were resentful. They were unhappy. And the kind of, quote, failures of the projects were all blamed on the villagers.
I think part of this also is that we still have not learned to deal with the reality that growth is not necessarily, economic growth is not necessarily right or appropriate all the time.
No. How can you have unlimited growth? I mean, what other dimension are you coming from of physics that you think unlimited
right.
growth can work? I'll make two comments on that. A very good colleague of mine, actually a very fine kind of heart-centered anthropologist and linguist working in Laos, James Chamberlain, he wrote a beautiful document called the Participatory Poverty Assessment of Laos. And he basically went around the country with a team of young Lao social scientists and asked people who said they were poor why they were poor. I mean, it's just a fascinating document. One thing he noted, this report was done for the Asian Development Bank, and he wrote in the report that one of the villages he worked in, the first year the team was there, the villagers said they had enough food to eat, they had everything they needed, they grew enough food. The next year they went back, and they did the same thing. Second year they were fine, they had enough food, everything was fine. Third year they went back, they had enough food. You know, they had their subsistence lifestyle was meeting their needs. And the Asian Development Bank defined this village as poor because it had no economic growth. And Jim commented on this in the report, and the ADB struck it out of the Asian Development Bank took it out of the final draft of the report.
I have been hoping and waiting, and I'm sure it exists somewhere, I just haven't found it yet, for economists to start looking at economies as ecosystems,
yeah,
where
right.
you do have growth. You have trees growing from seedlings, and then they reach maturity, and then they stop growing, but that's when they're the most fruitful.
Right.
So, in a sense, if you think of maturity and fruitfulness together and get the kind of growth thing out of your mind, except where it's appropriate. You know, new things obviously have to grow. You can't eat an apple off of a
right.
seedling apple tree that's 4 inches high.
Right.
But it does seem at least theoretically possible that we could have a natural model of economies.
Mm-hmm. And I think, and you just stimulated a recognition in my mind, is in our economy, we equate growth with consumption. But in some ways, they're the opposite. I mean, a tree stops growing as soon as you consume it. And basically, growth to our being and our economic system is consumption. If people aren't consuming stuff, you know, the economy can't grow. Now, during the Iraq War sometime when the president at the time told people, well, you're not feeling well.
Just go shopping.
Yeah, go out shopping. You're exporting your massive depression through violence on Iraq. So instead of dealing with that, let's forget about our depression and go shopping to alleviate, and we can think about something else.
Well, I went out the other day to buy a pair of socks, and several pairs of socks. And when I was in the store, I was watching the ladies shopping, and it was recreational. It was recreational shopping. They were buying things they didn't need, as I do, as many people do. because why? I mean, I went home and I was thinking about that. Why? Is it because there's something else missing? Is it because it's really satisfying? And it occurred to me to ask you, I mean, these people don't have, the people that you're talking about who live in the Salalah habitat don't have all this stuff and don't feel the need to own 17 shirts and 36 pairs of pants and who knows how many shoes. What is fulfilling for them? What are the fulfilling parts of their day, of their lives, of their interactions, of their connection with nature and each other?
Well, I mean, I can't, you'd have to, I would wish we could ask them. I mean, I don't want to try to speak
for
them. But I think one of the things is community. I mean, it's they live in a community, very closely connected community. Like, when I'm in Laos, like, sometimes I've been in this, I would come into work with my Lao colleagues, and they'd say, I said, oh, William, what did you do last night? I said, oh, I just went home and relaxed and watched a video. They said, alone? I said, yeah. I said, oh, God, we're really sorry. You know, like, couldn't imagine
right.
it. Or when I told Lao that I rented a house in the capital of Vientiane, they said, oh, who do you live with? I said, well, I live alone. Oh, God, we're really sorry to hear that. And it's this sense of community. And what I believe is humans are, we're genetically wired to live in community cooperative societies. A human being can't live alone. I mean, a Hmong villager or somebody, they can live alone in the forest for a while, for a few weeks, but they can't survive long. No human can survive long-term alone. And especially, you know, an infant up until the age of 12 or 14 is going to die without a community, without, so we're different from, you know, other animals that are solitary. So I believe we're basically hardwired to live in communities, and we feel better when we're in communities.
Well, and there's as much a mental and emotional part of that as the pure survival and
feeding
yourself.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Part.
That's what I'm. Yeah, exactly. I think we're emotionally attracted to living in supportive communities. So, I mean, libertarians and tea parties, they can have all they want about a fine economic theory that we should be completely individual and have individual choice and be dependent on ourselves and no one else can tell us what to do. Well, that's fine, but you know, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And my sense is that humans will be much happier and emotionally more stable and be urged to go out doing less shopping and, you know, less, you know, internet or whatever else they do if they're actually living in if you're in a mutually supportive community where people are supplying things that you need and you know you can rely on them, I think you're just going to feel much less stressful and have much less need to medicate your stress with drugs, alcohol, internet porn, and shopping. Yeah. I think that's just the way it is. And I said this socioeconomic theory that Americans have about the priority of the individual is fine, but what if it doesn't make you feel better to live that way?
What is the way forward? I mean, you're talking about a huge change in consciousness that goes against the grain of our, not only our economic model, but if we were to have this change in consciousness, it also would result, at least short term, in a lot of people. Let's say everybody stopped going shopping. Let's say we just stopped. We no longer shopped recreationally, but we hung out in our local public parks with each other and
right.
played games or played cards at night or whatever. I mean, just
yeah.
and stopped shopping for 6 months. Gazillions of people would lose their jobs.
Well, then maybe they'd find something more useful to do with their time than selling crap to other people that other people don't need. It's not a very valuable thing to do with your life. It actually might be a good thing.
No, maybe, but we have to eat.
Well, they can grow their own food then. They'd have lots of time to plant and grow their own food. And I'm not advocating going back to, you know, all I'm interested in is people being happy and having a sense of well-being. And we don't have that in the United States. You know, there's a lot of fear about, you know, gangbangers killing your children or whatever. More people in the United States kill themselves than die by homicide.
Is that right?
Yeah. More Americans each year die from suicide than from homicide. So the problem isn't out there. The problem is in each of us and how we're living in the world. And I'll give you just a little fragment. In my previous life, I worked in the early 1980s with Afghan refugees in northwestern Pakistan and Afghanistan, refugees from the Soviets. Afghan War I, which Americans didn't learn anything about, and just waded in and repeated the same mistake the Soviets made. And I helped an Afghan refugee, Safi, come to the United States. And after he'd been here, you know, 6 months, a year, my sister was visiting us and said, "Oh, Safi, you know, how's life in America?" And he said, "Yeah, Anne," my sister's name, said, "Yeah, of course life is good, and it'd be very difficult for me to go back to my life in Kabul because I came from a very poor family. So here in America, I've got an apartment, I have a job, I have a car, I have a girlfriend." He said, "But I don't have any time." He said, "My father in Afghanistan in Kabul was a tailor, and he didn't have a lot of money. But every day at 3 p.m., he and his friends would gather in his tailor shop and just sit around and drinking tea and talking. Nobody has time to do that in the United States."
We're talking to Bill Robichaud, and we've got a few minutes left. Let's go back to the Saola, and what next? You're leaving New Mexico. You'll be going back to Laos. What's the next step?
Yeah, we're narrowing down on basically five priorities. I don't know if we've been talking about so much. I don't know if I can remember them all. The first thing, we have near-term and long-term priority. The near-term priority is get these thousands of snares out of the forest. There are just thousands of wire snares set by commercial poachers. They're all illegal in the forests of Laos and Vietnam. So we're supporting the Lao and Vietnamese governments with training ranger patrols. We're also going to hopefully start providing incentives to Lao villagers to go out and collect these snares and turn them in, and we'll pay them for them.
Right.
Like they sell bamboo shoots, they can sell snares to us. So looking at any way we can solve the reduction of snares for the near term. For the long term, we're trying to develop young Lao and Vietnamese conservationists of the future. We've got several Lao master's degree students we're supporting. And we also have to find a way to detect Saola in the wild. So we're really going to give this leech method, really hard test. So hopefully, leeches are going to become like the sexiest thing. We're going to have leech t-shirts.
Good luck.
Remember, there was a time nobody knew about poison dart frogs. Remember that? And then suddenly poison dart frogs were like on exhibit in every museum and zoo around the world. And we're going to, next time I see you, you're going to have "I Love Leeches" t-shirt on. So those are the main directions where we're headed.
And have you found that there really is an increasing awareness in conservation groups? I mean, you talked about this wonderful thing with the Saola being made the logo animal of the
European Association of Zoos and Aquaria.
Right.
Their annual campaign.
What about other major international conservation groups?
Yeah, I think things are going well. WWF Vietnam and their Lao program are doing a lot of work. The Wildlife Conservation Society, based at the Bronx Zoo in New York, they're members of the Saola Working Group. They're doing fantastic work. They had teams out in the Lao forest, and in 2 months they picked up 4,000 snares in a Saola area. The Lao government is paying increasing attention to Saola conservation and government institutes in Vietnam, so the trend is good. What we're hoping is that it's, two or three minutes before midnight for Saola, not two or three minutes after. But in some ways it doesn't matter. We're going to do our best. We're going to put out all the stops to conserve this extraordinary example of beauty in the world. And if we fail, as Martine Prechtel up in Hohokaliente says, we're going to fail beautifully. We'll be able to do a lot of good along the way and a lot of good for other animals and hopefully the people who live in these areas.
Bill Robichaud is a zoologist. He's the coordinator of the Saola Working Group. What's your website?
It's savethesaola.org. And Saola, which is a Lao word, means spinning wheel arms. The villagers call it that because it's the same size and shape of the Saola horns, is S-A-O-L-A. So it's www.savethesaola.org.
Bill Robichaud, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll see you with any luck this time again next year.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.